This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We Americans pride ourselves on our democracy. But let's face it, when it comes to American politics, we're a pretty cynical bunch. As my guest E.J. Dionne puts it, for most of us, politics is a spectator sport barely worth watching. Dionne writes for The Washington Post, where he will soon start a new column about politics and ideas. He's a former New York Times reporter. Dionne's new book has the provocative title, Why Americans Hate Politics.
I think Americans have looked at the last 25 years of political campaigns, and what they see is a constant repetition of phony, divisive debates over cultural issues that either they've settled in their own minds or are meaningless. For example, if you look at how we argue about crime, people are legitimately worried about crime. But what we get in our campaigns instead is an endless argument over the death penalty. Now, there's a lot to say about the death penalty, but most people know that the death penalty won't do much about the crimes most people care about, rapes, robberies, murders, even. And that what they want is a real debate about how you solve the crime problem, and instead they get this symbolic debate about the death penalty. You could go through issue after issue after issue where what people are looking for from politics is some sense of solution and resolution of disputes, and what they get instead is this phony argument over and over.
Now, why are you very worried about the fact that Americans hate politics?
Well, I'm worried about it because we think of ourselves as a democracy, and we think of ourselves as a country that's special in the world because we are a democracy. And what we're getting is a country which is more fed up with democracy than all kinds of countries which have not known democracy for a long time. I think also that our politics is getting in the way of solving problems instead of helping to solve them. For example, on the talk about the family and what we're going to do about the family. What we've had in a lot of cases, especially in divisive political campaigns, is a debate which casts feminism and the traditional family as enemies of each other. Most people, in fact, have come to a number of conclusions on this issue. Americans as a whole are feminists in the sense that they believe that men and women are equal and should be treated equally. They also believe in the family and worry about how new arrangements we've created might be shortchanging children. What they want is a debate about how can you treat men and women equally and treat kids well at the same time. What they're getting instead is this debate which will not get us closer to resolving that central question.
What are some of the other recent low points in American politics that lead you to the conclusion that our politics have become trivial and stupid?
Well, for example, the Willie Horton campaign. Willie Horton became the central issue. Willie Horton, the man who was furloughed from a Massachusetts prison when he was there on a murder sentence and committed rape while he was on furlough. Now, the problem with the Willie Horton issue is that ought to be a unifying issue. Black Americans and white Americans are both terribly worried about how it is that we as a society are producing folks like Willie Horton. What is it that we're doing wrong? What is it in our social structure, in the structure of our opportunities that create Willie Hortons? What we got instead is this debate that really was tinged with racism and that appealed to people's emotions on race rather than discussing how can we solve this problem? How can we deal with something that is of concern to both black and white Americans? And that's the sort of thing that upsets me about what's happened to our politics, and I think it's why people have come to hate politics so.
What do you think about the way the debate about the Gulf War was carried out before the war started?
Well, actually, to my mind, that was a good moment. It was a rare time when you really saw people taking each other's arguments seriously. And it wasn't until after the war where people challenged each other's motives. At the time, people really said, look, we agree largely that Saddam Hussein is a bad guy and a menace. And the question is, how are we as a country going to deal with this? And that debate was very powerful and I think gave people a sense of how politics could be carried out if things went well in our country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is E.J. Dionne. He writes for The Washington Post. He's about to start a political column at the Post. His new book is called Why Americans Hate Politics. Do you think that the problem with politics today gets back to the system? Is it the system, the pollsters, the this and that, that's responsible for the superficiality? Or do you think that it's the ideology within the parties themselves that's responsible for the superficiality and triviality that we all complain about?
See, I think we have had a difficult time ever since what I call in the book the Cultural Civil War of the 1960s. That from, say, the end of World War II until the beginning of the 60s, the country felt itself at some kind of basic consensus on values, on lifestyles, on all of the rest. And so politics really did focus on a series of practical things that most people cared about. What happened in the 1960s is what I think was a necessary revolt against that kind of consensus politics. Feminists demanded a larger role for women. The civil rights movement demanded a larger role for black people. And on both the right and the left, there was a sense that that consensus that dominated the country had become a little bit too full of itself and was really unwilling to listen to arguments and counterarguments. And then, of course, there was the Vietnam War, which really tore us apart as a country. I think that we went through this necessary debate. The problem is the debate has lingered long past its time, that most Americans have actually made peace on those issues, that in some ways, I'm reminded when I think of the Cultural Civil War about a line Bruce Babbitt used to use in his 1988 presidential campaign for the Democratic nomination. He used to say, look, the Cold War is over, we've won. And I think the Cultural Civil War is largely over, and that liberal values in a whole series of areas have triumphed. And I think it's a mistake, especially for liberals, to try to continue to push on with this debate. I think the time has come to consolidate certain gains and see if one can marry the real gains that have been made by blacks, by feminists, marry those to what most middle-class Americans see as traditional values. I don't see that as an impossible marriage. I think that is the kind of marriage the country is looking for, if I can use a very traditional word like marriage.
What would be an example of how liberal values that triumphed in the 60s could be matched to traditional values? Give us an example.
Well, for example, it seems to me when we talk a lot these days about women in the workforce and about how are we going to take care of children when so many families have both parents out at work. One of the problems that always comes up is if a parent decides to take leave for a period of 6 or 8 months or a year to take care of the young child, what's going to happen to that person when they come back to work? Usually that person is a woman, and usually that person faces discrimination when she gets back to work in the sense that her job opportunities, her opportunities for promotion have been retarded by the fact that she decided to take a year off to take care of a kid. Now, is it pro-feminist or is it pro-family to say that's not fair, that if we value what this person does as a parent, we're not going to discriminate against them when they come back to work? I think it's both pro-feminist and pro-family to say we want that to stop.
Now, what do you think is holding back political candidates from addressing issues on a really practical level?
Well, I think
and trying to reach some kind of consensus, some kind of middle that you're talking about that unites people who ordinarily see themselves as being on opposite sides.
Well, I think that a couple of things have happened. I think conservatives gained a lot of ground by using divisive cultural issues to further their cause. What they did is they got a lot of votes from lower middle income, mainly white voters, by making these their central issues. Now, the conservatives have a problem because part of their constituency is this group of whites of modest income who basically like big government in a lot of areas. They want to cut taxes, but they don't want to cut big government. They like traditional values. The other part of the conservative constituency tends to be very well off. They tend to be pro-choice on everything from free markets to abortion. They don't want big government in any area. The conservatives, if they move boldly on anything, will blow their coalition apart. They will either lose this lower income wing or this upper income wing. So for conservatives, I think there's a powerful interest in keeping politics focused on these false choices on cultural issues. For liberals, it's much more complicated. I think that the main thing that happened to liberals in the 60s is that because they found themselves on the right side of history on civil rights, because they were right in saying it was time we did something for black Americans who had been discriminated against, what they did is they developed the great sin of people who are on that who are on the right side of history, which is moralism. And when white middle-class Americans said, look, my taxes have gone way up, way beyond where they should be, liberals tended to say these folks are selfish. When these folks complained about crime, they were accused of being racist when what they were really worried about is crime. So I think liberals gave this opening to conservatives on cultural issues, and conservatives are continuing to play that card as long as they can. I think liberals need to make peace with the broad middle class, and that if they did that, they could actually do more for these other values that they also represent.
Well, how would they do that? How are you suggesting liberals try to make peace with the mainstream?
Well, for example, I think there's a whole other area, which is taxation. That one of the things that happened in the 1980s and also before the 1980s is that taxes became much heavier on middle-income Americans. And taxes went up most on middle-income Americans with children. It seems to me liberals could argue that it is both pro-family and very progressive to start cutting tax rates on middle-income families, especially those who are performing the most important social job there is in the country, which is bringing up children. You're seeing some of this happening in Congress. A couple of weeks ago, Senator Gore, Representative Downey, George Miller of California, and Representative Obie introduced a tax bill to do just this, to cut taxes on middle and lower income people and really concentrate benefits on families with children.
Now, I just want to say, you're arguing that these false choices are based on ideological differences within each of the political camps. But I still think the argument can be made that these false choices are being presented because it takes too long to really discuss the issues. And you can't do that in a soundbite. And if you really discuss the issues, you might alienate somebody. And everybody's terrified of doing that. That nobody seems to really want to take the time in politics to actually discuss an issue.
Well, I agree with you to the extent that I think both broad coalitions, Democrat and liberal, Republican and conservative, are shot through with contradictions, and they're worried about blowing those coalitions apart. I think that for conservatives, in a way, you can't blame conservatives for trying to keep the discussion on a road that's been very helpful to them up to now. I think they are running out of gas, and I think people are going to start asking more of them, but that's worked for them. For liberals, frankly, I don't understand why they don't try to change this discussion, because it's clearly been so damaging to them, the way we have discussed politics in the last 20 years. And I think that you're going to start seeing liberals try to change the discussion because they realize that they're just going to keep losing presidential elections if they don't. I think something else happened to our politics back in the 60s that, to me, two crucial events were the Goldwater campaign and the McGovern campaign. Now, I happen to admire both Goldwater and McGovern as very honest and decent human beings, but the fact of the matter is both of their movements represented the interests of different wings of the upper middle class, that the Goldwater movement was a group of essentially upper middle class people who were concerned about communism and high taxes and big government. The McGovern constituency was another group of upper middle class people who were concerned primarily with foreign policy, foreign intervention, and abstract rights, if you will. That this debate between Goldwaterism and McGovernism has dominated our politics. Most Americans aren't either Goldwaterite or McGovernite. Most of them aren't engaged by these issues. What they are looking for are practical remedies. And that's why I think we created a problem for ourselves when those two wings became so powerful in the parties. It's not even a question of being left-wing and right-wing. It's a question of what issues really engage them, and I think that's what was wrong.
Well, how powerful did they really become, though? It was, after all, Nixon that got into the White House.
It is, but I think that what Nixon found when he got in the White House, actually, there's an interesting paradox. I mean, you can't talk about Richard Nixon without using the words either paradox or irony. And I think that the paradox of the Nixon administration is that if you go back and look at his record, on an awful lot of issues, Richard Nixon was quite a bit more liberal than, say, Jimmy Carter. That the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, got created under Nixon. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration got created under Nixon. We indexed Social Security under Nixon. Nixon had this relatively liberal record on a whole series of domestic issues. But Nixon made a decision in 1972 that if he ran as a liberal, it really wouldn't help him nearly as much as if he ran on these divisive social issues. And so he ran against busing. He ran against what he called acid amnesty and abortion. And so I think Nixon took what is a fairly moderate political position and gave it a much more right-wing cast, which I think put us down this road, and that acid amnesty and abortion is not all that different from Willie Horton and the Pledge of Allegiance.
If you're just joining us, my guest is E.J. Dionne. He writes for The Washington Post, where he's about to start a new column on politics and ideas, and he's the author of the new book, Why Americans Hate Politics. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Washington Post writer E.J. Dionne is my guest, author of the new book, Why Americans Hate Politics. Now, you suggest in your book that conservatism has run out of gas.
Right. I think that really conservatives don't know where to move, and you're seeing that in the relative the relative emptiness, if you will, of President Bush's domestic program, that he's really had to scramble around to try to do something on the domestic side. I think the cause of that, as we talked about earlier, is this contradiction within the conservative coalition, that there are such diverse strains within that coalition. I mean, Jerry Falwell really doesn't have a whole lot in common with an investment banker who lives in Manhattan, that those wings simply can't agree on a way forward. I also think that they have a problem because the No New Taxes pledge was so central to their winning elections because so many middle-class people felt overtaxed. But if you're stuck on the No New Taxes pledge, as last year's budget fight showed, you really can't do much about all the domestic issues that Bush likes to talk about. You can't put more money into environmental agencies. You can't put more money into education. You can't put more money into road building. Indeed, you can't put more money into anything that might halt this recession, which is hitting some parts of the country really hard. And so because they can't really move in one direction or another, I think they're stalled, and that's why they've run out of gas.
Who made liberalism a dirty word in mainstream politics?
Well, I think liberalism became a dirty word because it became so associated with certain forms of cultural experimentation that a lot of people didn't like. Over time, in fact, people made peace with some of those forms of cultural experimentation, like feminism. But initially, they associated it instead with Richard Nixon's old line, acid amnesty and abortion. I think that's part of the problem. I think the second part of the problem is liberalism historically, under FDR and Harry Truman, was associated with giving help to both the poor and the broad middle class. Probably the best piece of social legislation we ever passed in our country was the GI Bill, which basically told a whole huge cross-section of Americans that the government is going to help you go to college and it's going to help you buy a home, the two prerequisites of middle-class life. I think in the 1960s, liberals came to be seen as people who divided the country into two camps, the very wealthy and the very poor, and that they had forgotten about that great mass of people in the middle who felt government ought to pay attention to their problems. I think, again, the task of liberalism is to unite the broad middle class with the poor on behalf of a program that's going to give people real opportunity. I think liberals lost their way because they lost sight of that.
For the past few years, the question in the Democratic Party always seems to be, should the party become more liberal or move more to the center in order to become more relevant to voters in America? Do you think that that's the right question?
Yeah, I think that's entirely the wrong question. I think that this talk about should they become more liberal, should they move left or right? I mean, obviously, Democrats are not going to succeed if they are a second-rate version of the Republican Party. That's what liberals always say, and they're right. But what does moving to the center mean? In my book, I talk about the center not in terms of some ideological position, but the place where most Americans are. And what most Americans are looking for are a combination of activist government, which would make you rather liberal, but an activist government that's willing to stand up for certain kinds of values. For example, what people are looking for from welfare is a new approach that would make it easier for people to work and create some incentives for people to work. One of the proposals that's happily gained ground in Washington over time is to take working poor people, people who have families, for example, where at least one person works full time but have no health insurance and fall below the poverty line. These are people who are living by all of the rules that good middle class Americans believe in, and they're good rules. But we're not doing anything to tell these people, hey, we're proud of you and we want to help you continue to do this. What we've done by not helping the working poor is to tell people, well, you might as well be on welfare because you might get more if you're on welfare than you work. It seems to me liberals have an opportunity to cast this argument not in negative terms that we want to punish the poor, but in positive terms that we want to tell poor people we want to help and we want to make it easier for you to seize opportunities. That's what liberalism always used to be about, and I don't think it's that way in the minds of people anymore. So I don't think it's a question of moving to the center or moving to the left or moving to the right. I think it's moving toward this consensus, which I think is very strong out in the country.
Moving toward more practical look at the issues as opposed to either ideological or symbolic.
Right. I mean, ideology is supposed to inform us about how we look at the world. It's supposed to teach us something about what categories might be useful to us. It's not supposed to be a straitjacket, and I think it has become a straitjacket. So, yeah, that's what you said is exactly what I think, which is that we must We must get more practical in our politics. I mean, we're a country that faces extraordinary challenges to our economy from the Germans, from the Japanese, from the rising countries of Asia. We're a country where the middle class has sort of stagnated for the last 20 years. We're a country where we're having real problems educating our kids. Why in the world shouldn't we talk about those problems instead of having these endless symbolic arguments? I think people would respond to that. I think that's what they're looking for, and they're not getting that, and that's why they hate politics.
Okay, E.J. Dionne, I hear a lot of our listeners thinking, well, if this guy's got all of the answers, why doesn't he run for office?
Somebody at a meeting I went to where I gave a speech asked that wonderful question and said, do you have any plans to run for anything? And I said, I have no plans to run for anything, which always means the person probably intends to run for something. The answer is I've liked what I've been doing so far, and I like being a voice in the debate. I admire people who run for office, and in fact, I think it would be fun.
Do I hear you saying you're considering it?
Oh, I wouldn't say I'm seriously considering it. I just think it's an interesting task, and I admire people who do it, and I especially admire people who do it in this climate where it's pretty rough on all of them.
When you look around the world, do you think Americans are unique in hating politics?
No. That's a great question. I think that you've seen in a lot of countries in the West some of the same things that have happened to us for some of the same reasons. I think that you're seeing declining voter turnouts in a lot of other countries. But I do think that we have a particular problem. I think that most countries in Western Europe, for example, have had a much more practical orientation. They haven't demonized government the way the right has in our country. They haven't been quite so skeptical of what we sometimes mistakenly call traditional values as some liberals have in our country. I think there is a much more practical debate in a lot of Western Europe. But I do think that a kind of consumer society of the sort that we're building all over the world perhaps doesn't value public engagement in quite the same way that we may have valued it 30 years ago. I think some of the other part of it is that we have solved certain problems. I think that by and large, people are better off. In the middle of the Depression, people turned to politics urgently because it was the only place they could go to solve problems. Obviously, we don't have quite that same kind of catastrophe going on in our country. So that the move away from politics is not all bad, but I think it is largely a bad thing because it undermines people's sense that they are self-governing and ought to play a part in the process of governing themselves.
Well, E.J. Dionne, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I thank you so much.
And E.J. Dionne is a writer for The Washington Post and the author of the new book, Why Americans Hate Politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.